In 2017, Congress passed and President Trump signed the Tax Cuts and Job Act of 2017. The CBO estimated that implementing the act would add an estimated 1.891, let's say almost 2 million, trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years. That's trillion with a T, folks. This would be in addition to the 9.8 trillion increased forecast under the current policy baseline, an existing $20 trillion national debt. Those are some big numbers. It does not appear that, as claimed, the tax cuts will pay for themselves. In June, the CBO estimated federal debt held by the public will rise from 78% of GDP at the end of this year to 96% in 2028.
So how do these debt levels compare to those seen in the past? And what are the implications of rising debt for the American economy in general and for government programs in particular? If the debts are in dollars, can't we just print some more of them? And why can't we fix the problem simply by cutting wasteful spending? We're fortunate this morning to have someone with us with a surplus of knowledge on these important topics. William Gale of the Brookings Institution, the author of a new book, Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. Good morning, Mr. Gale. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Can we start by adding a little bit more historical context to where we are in terms of the debt? I know Renee mentioned that we're at levels unseen of since World War II. Can you flesh that out for us a little bit?
Sure. In the before about 1980, we only had big debt during wars or recessions, and it would go away as soon as the war ended or the recession and the economy recovered. Then after 1980, when Reagan cut taxes and raised defense spending, we had deficits going up during a peacetime prosperous period. Policymakers then enacted a whole series of what with retrospect looked like remarkable bipartisan efforts to control the debt. And then Bush, Obama, and Trump, for various reasons, have boosted the debt again. So we're not just high relative to the past, except for World War II. The main way we're different from the past is now these deficits are permanent. They're not going to go away with a war ending. They're not going to go away with a recession ending. We're just on this upward path. And that's what troubles people who look at the situation. The current debt level would be manageable if it were coming down, but it's going up basically persistently and permanently.
So structurally, when we look at debt and our nation's debt, how can we evaluate it in its relative terms or its relative significance? The one measure I've seen is looking at the debt relative to the size of the GDP. Why is that an appropriate measure, and what does it tell us?
Sure. If you just look at the dollar amount of debts, it's kind of staggering, and it's hard to put it into perspective. The scaling debt by GDP, saying debt is a share of the economy, is like someone comparing their mortgage debt to their income, mm-hmm. right? If you know what their income is, you have a much better sense of whether their mortgage debt is affordable or not. So, but relative to our income, our debt is high and it's going up, and that's precisely the long-term concern.
And one more question on the relative nature of it. How do we compare in terms of the relationship between our debt and our GDP to other developed countries?
We have more than most other countries. In fact, more than all but a very few countries. Greece and Japan have more than we do, but I think Portugal does. But 15 years ago, that would have been different. 20 years ago, we were more in the middle of the pack. But other countries have parliamentary political systems where a party comes in and they can simply make changes, whereas our founding fathers designed our political system to make it difficult to make big changes. So we've been sort of stymied and sort of thinking about these long-term solutions by the lack of partisanship. By the heightened partisanship that is in Washington these days.
Well, that kind of leads us to our next question. During the discussion of the 2017 tax bill, there were claims that economic growth would pay for tax cuts. How would that work, and does it appear to be happening?
Yeah, just because an idea is wrong doesn't mean it ever goes away. the evidence, the tax cut certainly did not pay for itself. It didn't come close to paying for itself. And there's all sorts of evidence to show that. It did probably help boost the economy in the short term, but people are worried that that's a little bit of what's called a sugar high. That is, any tax cut that puts money in people's pockets will cause, you know, spending to go up in the short term. And it's not clear that the tax cut has laid the foundation for longer term growth. Just that it gave people money to spend that they went out and spent.
Weren't we hearing, though, that most Americans were not seeing the tax cuts that they thought they were promised?
Yeah, that was a confusion that the way the tax cut seems, the amount that people got withheld from their paychecks. And so refunds for some people were smaller than they would have thought. There was a lot of confusion about this, but although I am not a fan of the tax cut, I will say most people, the overwhelming majority of people, did get a tax cut, but it showed up in their paycheck rather than in their refund.
So they were taking home more money throughout the year, but then when they were used to getting that big refund in spring, that didn't happen.
Right, or maybe it wasn't as big or right, but there was the refund is a very visible indicator for most people, and actually for many people it's the biggest source of income, the biggest single payment of income they receive all year.
Wow.
So it's a very salient characteristic of the tax system for people. But if people actually looked at their overall taxes, they'd find that 80% of people did get tax cuts.
Bouncing back to the growth question for just a second, what kind of rate of growth in the GDP would it have taken for the sort of concept of the tax cuts paying for themselves to play out? And I can't help but comment that when you said just because an idea is wrong doesn't mean it goes still around. I suppose one way of putting it is that concept's a laugher.
I don't have the exact number for what the economy would have had to have grown to pay for itself, but the Congressional Budget Office estimates that at the end of the first decade, the economy would be 0.1% larger as a result of the tax cut. So that's 0.1%. That's certainly not going to do it.
No.
When you're cutting corporate taxes by 40% and individual taxes by about 10%.
What if we don't fix it?
So we're sitting here looking at each other going, okay, this is staggering. So what do we do to fix it? How do we balance our budget, or is that the answer?
Oddly enough, balancing the budget is not required. What we need to do is stabilize the debt over time relative to the size of the economy. And you can do that. You can run small deficits because the economy is growing. You can run small deficits and still stabilize the debt relative to the GDP. But you know, I'm going to give you a really boring answer. We need to cut spending and raise taxes. And there's no magic third way that will get us out of this. And people don't like to hear that answer,
yeah.
But that's the answer.
Are there any major entitlement programs you're seeing in the budget that you think are easy cuts?
It depends what you mean by easy. I think the area where we could cut spending with the least damage to people's benefits is in health care. There seems to be a lot of waste and excess spending and corrupt billing and overcharging and stuff like that. And so... But you know that requires mining into the healthcare industry and rooting out this kind of spending. But the bigger point is that the three biggest areas of federal spending are Social Security, healthcare, and the military, and those are very popular areas of healthcare spending. So it's going to be very hard to cut the big chunks of spending, the big areas of spending. The areas like, you know, Department of Education or Department of Commerce or something like that people talk about sometimes, those are tiny cuts. And so people talk about those things, but they wouldn't, they're a rounding error in terms of the federal budget.
So your initial answer about looking at health care, you're talking about cutting waste. You're not talking about cutting Medicare.
Well, waste in Medicare, yes. The way Medicare lets doctors bill for services provided rather than outcomes obtained could be changed. The way Medicare acts plans to compete with each other could be changed to encourage more competition, more competitive bidding. And there's actually a really another really important way that Medicare runs into this is Medicare pays more for the drugs that it purchases than Medicaid or Veterans Affairs or anybody else. They pay like 20-25% more. And there's no reason Medicare should have to pay more for these drugs than Medicaid does.
Yeah.
And so allowing Medicare to negotiate which drugs they cover and what prices they will pay could actually save an enormous amount of money. The estimates are it could save $500 billion over 10 years.
Was that part of the negotiations that enabled the passage of Part D, that in order to get Part D through, they agreed not to let Medicare negotiate with the drug companies?
I'm sure that came up in that discussion, and it was squashed, yeah.
Okay, so when we look at, we talk about healthcare. Is there any viable way to look at potentially cutting Social Security costs?
Well, I think we have to. The program is out of balance. And by 2035, it'll only be able to pay about 75% of the benefits that people are owed. You know, one way to deal with that in terms of the arithmetic is simply to cut benefits by 25%. But I don't think anybody actually wants that solution. And so what we need to do is first come up with some more revenue sources for Social Security, which is adjusting the payroll tax. And second, we need to kind of reform and refine the benefits. I think what's going to happen is we're going to reduce benefits for high-income households a fair amount. And I think that for two reasons. One is the longer we wait to deal with this, the harder it's going to be to come up with a comprehensive solution. And the other is that policymakers look at who gets Social Security benefits. They're going to say, gee, you know, an elderly couple making $250,000 a year does not really need as much Social Security benefits as we thought. So I think that's where you're going to see the major trimming in terms of benefit formulas. But the other thing is we're going to have to raise the retirement age. I think people are living longer than in the past, and it just makes sense to boost the age a couple of years over the next 30 or 40 years.
I don't know if you're going to have an answer to this, but the sort of political deal that was sold to the American public in terms of Social Security was that I pay into it, I get out of it. So I guess one of the questions I ask is, do you have a sense whether actuarially people are getting more than they should out of Social Security, less than they should, or that these cuts, the kinds of cuts we're talking about, would somehow alter the actuarial deal that was cut here?
Yeah, that's a great question. The way Social Security works is it's a pay-as-you-go system, which is essentially the benefits that current workers pay in go right out the door to current retirees. So people think they're kind of building up an account, and they are getting credit for their work, but there's no balance actually building up that has your name on it the way it would in a 401k or something like that.
Exactly.
And so what that means is the first generation of retirees got a great deal. You know, they paid in either not at all or just for a few years, and then they got all these retirement benefits. And now we're all paying in our whole career and then getting retirement benefits. So we have a much less good deal, whether it's slightly better than average or slightly worse than average, depends on your assumptions. But you're right. If we then cut benefits and raise taxes in the future, it's definitely going to be a worse than average deal. But that's because the country sent these resources to the earlier generations.
So we've talked about cuts. What about revenue increases? How can the government raise more money to help pay off this deficit? What have other developed countries done in the past, if anything?
Well, the two obvious candidates here are a value-added tax and a carbon tax. A value-added tax is a national consumption tax that every country in the world has except us. A carbon tax is an idea whose time has come, not just for green reasons or climate change reasons, but because right now we underprice carbon, so we almost by definition produce too much of it. So we could raise revenues, we could help deal with other issues via a carbon tax. There are other changes, there are ways we can reform the existing system, but I think the two main things are that we need a value-added tax and that we should put a price on carbon.
Let's talk about both of those. First of all, with respect to the value-added tax, I think in one of the pieces of yours that I read over the weekend, you talked about why both Republicans and Democrats don't like it. One thinks it's a cash machine, and the other, well, I can't remember what the other one does.
I think it's regressive.
Right. Can you sort of flesh that out a little bit?
Sure. As a tax on consumption, the value-added tax hits low-income people harder than an income tax would, because the income tax has the standard deductions and has rates that rise over time. And so the VAT is called regressive compared to an income tax. There's an easy way to fix that, which is essentially to give everybody either an exemption of their first $20,000 of consumption, or to do what European countries do, which is to spend more on social initiatives essentially as compensation. So they have much more on family and child care policies and stuff like that, and they finance it with a consumption. So the famous saying was from Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary in the 1980s. He said that we don't have a VAT because conservatives think it's a money machine and liberals think it's progressive, and that we will get one eventually when liberals realize it's a money machine and conservatives realize it's regressive. And I think it's a pretty good description of the politics even now, 30 years later. But it's important to note that a variety of Republicans have proposed value-added taxes over the last decade. Paul Ryan, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Herman Cain, all of their plans were actually value-added taxes, but they called them something else because they didn't want to say the word value-added tax because that sounded too European.
Let's talk about a carbon tax. You said right now we underprice carbon. What do you mean by that?
The emission of carbon dioxide creates molecules in the atmosphere that get trapped and cause global warming, which causes climate change, et cetera. We're seeing the effects of climate change. Certainly hundreds of scientists have signed together on the negative effects of climate change, the fact that it's been induced by human behavior. And the reason there's, quote, too much, unquote, carbon emissions is that people don't have to pay the full price of the carbon emissions. So if they're just paying the private cost, they're not paying the implied social cost. So a carbon tax would raise the price of emitting carbon dioxide, so that people would face that cost and hence would produce less of it or find other ways to produce things or other ways to consume things. And that would remove the missing tax in the economy, essentially, the missing correction.
Let's bring this home for our listeners. So how would you figure out what your carbon tax would be? What are some things that we're doing right now that we would be less inclined to do other than, say, drive?
Driving is one. A lot of it would be in production processes. I mean, basically, it's the consumption of coal, oil, natural gas, in particular coal. So it may not affect so much what people consume, but it would have a big effect on how things got produced. You have to think that industry would be more susceptible to finding substitutes for various production methods that are too carbon intensive.
But wouldn't they just pass on those costs to the consumer?
Well, if you've got like a good, there's two issues here. One is would a carbon tax in general be passed forward to consumers? I think the answer is yes. But at the same time, companies would be looking for more efficient production methods so that they didn't have to pass the cost to the consumer and so that they could charge lower amounts for what they produce.
Or on a personal level, if there was a carbon tax, you might be willing to spend more money to insulate your home because you would realize that you were paying out more for your natural gas or whatever.
Right. That's a good example of the trade-offs involved, yes.
So we've been talking to William Gale of the Brookings Institution, who has written some really interesting things about the federal debt, the structural imbalance, and where we might go in the future. His new book is entitled Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. Thanks for joining us this morning.